You're listening to the Myth Cream Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Mike Hernandez, and Chris Winkle.
There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. 'Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do. So she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode is brought to you by our patrons, Ari Ashkenazi and Professor of Political Theory in Star Trek, Kathy Ferguson.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Myth Creates Podcast. I'm Oren. With me today is...
Chris.
And joining us for the first time is our new special guest, Graham.
Hello.
Graham, why don't you tell the listeners at home just a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Fittingly, can I introduce the topic of this episode, Oren?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because please, I am, in fact, your dark reflection.
Oh, no.
I am who you could have become.
You do have a goatee. I can confirm that. That is a known fact.
I have a goatee. I'm also evil. I worship the great Cthulhu. And I give Oren editing work, which is so also evil. An evil act. So
yeah, it's just terrible. My chosen profession.
Well, I think this is a good setup, because now that I can compare the two of you, I can really see Oren's dark side, whereas, like, I couldn't tell before, but now, like, looking at you guys side by side, but you know, Graham, I'm also feeling a little more sympathetic towards you, like, I can now see your light side, because Oren is
well,
here.
Thank you. Then I can corrupt you and turn you to the darkness. And you can make wrong choices.
We'll be careful to get a dark Chris in here next episode.
Oh, no.
That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, that happened.
All right, so we're talking about heroes with evil reflections, like Graham said. And I was just going to say that the reason that you do that is because it, you know, is cool. I didn't have a real reason to, explain why, but, you know, Chris and Graham have already covered that pretty well, I think.
Yeah, well, it definitely has novelty. I mean, there is just something, like, fun and entertaining about seeing, like, a hero but an evil version.
Mm-hmm.
Besides just the actual using it to develop your characters more.
Yeah, and I think it kind of plays to a philosophy of developing villains that I'm very fond of, which is that they don't see themselves necessarily as villains.
Right.
They see themselves as people who are acting, you know, for a righteous cause of their own, but they're willing to, like, take it directions that the heroes obviously aren't, and go past certain moral boundaries.
I also like it because I think it is useful for people to consider what they might have turned out if they had been in different circumstances. Because circumstances, you know, affect us to varying degrees. And so I'm a fan of the idea of a villain who could have been the hero if things had been different, or vice versa. I think my favorite example of that is actually William Adama and Helena Kane from the new Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
Because, okay, so they have a lot of similar, like, traits just on surface-wise, right? Like, they're both military officers, they're both really into antiques. I mean, granted, most base captains are into antiques, but,
For some reason.
For some reason. I don't know why.
I think it's like the captain thing. That they all saw Master and Commander and they really liked it.
Yeah, probably. But what makes Kane a dark reflection of Adama is that both of them are motivated originally by the same idea, which is total war against the Cylons. That was what Adama wanted to do at the start of the series. He was like, I'm going to go, you know, stick it to the enemy. I have a ship. That's my job. And Kane thought the same thing. And Adama was fortunate to have people like Rosalyn around him who could say, no, that won't do any good. We have to protect the few people we have left. Kane didn't have anybody like that, and so Kane launched her war and became more and more extreme in the purpose of pursuing her war, to the point where she's okay with just executing prisoners and sees no value in the civilian population and stuff like that.
Yeah, that certainly shows how having an evil reflection can be used for commentary. Right?
Yeah.
And sort of understanding how humans can go bad. So I do think that Battlestar also lost an opportunity, though, with all of the Cylon models.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many, you know, sixes and sevens, and they didn't do a very good job, or, I mean, they didn't have to do it, but I think it would have been cool if we had had a little bit more development for some of those Cylons and more comparison between them and the others of their model. And yeah, looking at how they're the same and how they're different.
I'd agree with that. There was something of that between Boomer and Athena. Boomer being kind of on the Cylon side and Athena gradually turning more to the human side because she loved Hilo and all that. But it was not really developed until later when the show had started to fall apart. And if we'd had that right from the beginning, like, if we'd seen more of Athena sympathizing with the humans and Boomer gradually leaning more towards misanthropy, even when she was a crew member of the Galactica, it could have had a really interesting, like, parallel development.
Yeah.
Also, I was going to say Caprica 6 feels like she was kind of a missed opportunity because she sympathized with Baltar and was in love with Baltar, but we never really saw a 6 that went the other way.
One thing to consider, I think, when looking at the character development of Athena and Boomer is that we are missing the very obvious development of the baby that cures cancer. Because Athena had and Boomer didn't. So I think that clearly shows that one of them was different than the other one.
Mm-hmm. If you love someone enough, maybe your baby will cure your cancer. Or other people's cancer.
Yeah. To mention another thing about, like, dark reflections, I think that it's when you're doing one, I think it's important to have the characters actually share more than superficial traits, right? Because I mentioned, like, Adama and Kane have those superficial traits in common, but then they have more than that. Whereas, like, an example that I see a lot on the internet of a character that's supposed to be a dark reflection is Harry Potter and Voldemort. Because they're both, like, orphans that had, like, bad homes that they came from. And they both, like, did similar things, like, they both opened the Chamber of Secrets and all that, but they don't have anything in common, like, motivation-wise, right? Like, their personalities are completely different, even back when it was Tom Riddle. He didn't strike me as anything like Harry Potter.
Yeah, it's a little weird because I could kind of understand the parallels, and I think certainly Rowling was trying to bring those parallels out. At the same time, if you go and actually look at, like, where Tom Riddle is supposedly is coming from, it did not feel like the Dursleys. And
yeah.
So if he had a family that really did feel like the Dursleys, then maybe it would have worked a little bit better. It's just that they had the same things happen to them, but then they one person made it more positive than the other. But when we go back to Tom Riddle's home, it doesn't really feel like that.
Yeah, I'd agree. And I think that even at Hogwarts, Tom doesn't seem like he's searching for solutions to problems so much as the few flashes we see, and this, I think, was a construction of Rowling's because she needed to build up the villain to be, like, really, really evil. But the few flashes we see of Tom at Hogwarts are him trying to construct problems, whereas Harry spends all his time at Hogwarts trying to solve problems.
Yeah, I will say that this is really a tactic that works really well for making villains sympathetic and bringing out the flaws in the hero, and clearly Rowling was not interested in doing that. Like, Harry is not a character that has substantial flaws, and she did not want to make Voldemort sympathetic, so, you know, the only thing that there is left is the novelty of the technique, which is, you know, something, but, you know, again, wasted opportunity there.
There was definitely some idea that, like, Harry might have something in common with Voldemort. Like, they have that whole drama about the fact that he's a Parseltongue, and so is Voldemort. And, like, they did that thing. But that felt kind of flat for me, because I didn't really feel like Harry had anything in common. If I felt like they did, maybe that would have worked better.
I think that Rowling used the whole Parseltongue, and also, like, in book 5, when he's, like, feeling possessed. Like, she uses it to add internal conflict and make him worry about things, but I don't feel like there's a substantial push to make a possibility that Harry could actually go bad, so much as just make him worried, which, after this, I'm hoping we'll talk about Star Wars a little bit, where Star Wars actually tries to create that possibility.
Oh, yeah. I put this in the show notes, that Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker are, I would think, a much more successful variation on this. Because they start out, or at least Darth Vader when he was younger, Anakin, and his son.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at Anakin and Luke, absent the quality of the prequels, obviously, which are terrible, even evil, I can recognize that. Anakin and Luke are both, you know, these brash, reckless young heroes who just kind of dive into stuff without thinking, and they long for adventure. And when they're confronted with a situation, they usually default to their passions. To the point that if Luke had not had Vader standing there as, you know, the example of what had happened to his father, if Luke had never learned that Vader was his father, he might have turned to the dark side.
I will say, you know, just for me, looking at just the original three films, I like, especially since this soul turning to the dark side thing is kind of vague, and it's never really explained very well how somebody could just, like, have emotions and become more evil. And I do think that Luke, you know, he has a father who is turned to the dark side, you know, and he's told that his father took that path. And I feel like that, even just in the original, without seeing the prequels, is sort of essential to selling the idea that that is actually a possibility for Luke. Like, I don't think without Vader that they could have sold the idea that it would be possible for Luke to go bad. Even, I mean, they did some scenes where he showed a little bit of dark side, but at the same time, that idea of going all the way because it's some, you know, magical, metaphysical thing, I feel like they needed that, you know? And similarly, it would have been impossible to believe that Vader could have become good without Luke there, and Luke, you know, insisting on it.
There are a couple of subtle things in the original trilogy that also hint at this idea that Luke and Vader could, you know, have gone down the same path depending on their circumstances. Whenever Luke starts a fight by igniting his lightsaber first, he always does badly. He either loses, like in the duels with Vader in Empire, or he clearly goes too far and like, you know, has like an explosion of rage, or in the cave when he like cuts off the ghost Vader's head and it was revealed to be him. Like, the movie uses those tricks to sort of imply that when Luke fights with aggression, he is doing a bad thing. Whereas when he turns on his lightsaber in defense, he wins those fights.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. I had not noticed that.
I mean, it's a small thing. It's not hugely important, but it shows, I think, some of the subtleties you can get into when you're trying to show these dark reflections of each other.
Yeah, that's cool.
I think that ties into one of the places that the dark reflection idea comes from. I just wanted to dig into the roots for just a little minute, which is, it comes both, I think, from the doppelganger, which is the idea of someone exactly like you who lives a completely different life, and the idea from Carl Jung of the shadow self, which is this self-concept within you that represents everything that you deny or repress or dislike about yourself, your negative qualities. And a series that I'm very fond of is the Persona series of video games, which is so into shadow selves that the characters, the heroes in those games, especially in Persona 4, the most recent, come into literal conflict within these mental worlds with their shadow selves. And the only way they survive is they have to conquer their shadow self in a battle and then accept it. Because if they reject it again, it'll just come back stronger. And if they accept it into themselves, it becomes their persona, which is both a psychological mask they use to face the world and a Pokemon-style monster they send out to hit other monsters in the face.
Well, it's got to be a Pokemon-style monster in there somewhere,
right?
Well,
I mean, you know, you got to have something.
That's certainly so, very interesting.
So now we're talking about Jung on this podcast, which I think is like three or four levels of highbrow above where we normally are.
I mean, well, you got lawyers in here, now you got philosophy.
It's true. And, of course, Persona also has, I think, like a giant bear. I think that's also very symbolic of something.
Yes, Teddy is definitely symbolic of bears.
Of bears, yeah.
And the archetype of small Japanese perverts.
An example that is not as subtle, perhaps, as some of what we're talking about is, but still I would argue just as effective, is Korra and Kuvira in The Legend of Korra Season 4. They tried this in Season 2 with Unalaq, who becomes a literal dark avatar, but it didn't work because there was never any idea that Unalaq was anything but a bad guy. Like, when he first shows up, he's obviously sinister, even though he, like, says he's helping them. It's like, yeah, we can tell you're evil. Like, you're not fooling us.
Yeah, that's not sympathetic.
Right, he's not sympathetic, and his reasons for, like, doing what he wants to do are, like, apocalypse, basically. It's very, he doesn't have a motivation.
Plus, even before apocalypse, he has that whole thing where he wants to frame people's dad. He wants to frame Korra's dad. And it's like, that's not a way to build sympathy. That's just weird.
Whereas if someone like Kuvira legitimately starts off as a good guy. Kuvira is first introduced as a soldier fighting against the villains of Season 3. And then in Season 4, she is dealing with some of the problems that were started by the villains in Season 3. So we are immediately kind of on her side, and she and Korra have a lot in common. They are both very powerful benders who like to solve their problems with force, and have very little patience for complex, difficult issues, and think that they can just, you know, bull rush through them. They basically think that they are always Alexander cutting the knot, right? They're like, yeah, yeah. this is a difficult problem, but if I just bend at it hard enough, it will go away. And both of them think that way. And I would argue this is almost a commentary on the fact that Korra has that same mindset for 3 seasons and never changes. And I kind of feel like someone in the writer's room noticed that and was like, we should probably change that and address that on some level.
Yeah, they really did a lot of self-correcting in mm-hmm. Season 4.
They absolutely brought in
an outside eye, or I don't know.
I'm not sure what happened exactly. I just know that, like, when you have Kuvira expressing frustration with the same problems that Korra has expressed frustration with, and then doing basically the same thing Korra does, but taking it just far enough that Korra can see why it's wrong, that gives Korra the opportunity for growth, and it makes us, like, you know, it makes us invested in Kuvira. Like, we don't want her to win, but we understand why she's doing the things she's doing, and that's not something every villain needs, but I think it's powerful when it's used correctly.
Yeah, for sure.
I actually, that's one of the things I'm fondest about in the Dark archetype, is where it can lend credence to both the hero and the villain. And I'm going to bring up one that's been brought up before on the podcast, which is Madoka Magica.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Where Homura and Madoka start out as very, very similar people. They're kind, they're caring, they're gentle, and they're so similar that they're very interested in each other right from the beginning. But then, as a result of their eventual conflict, like, and their interactions, Homura becomes this bitter shell of a person who is driven by one desire, and that's to save the person she loves at any cost ever. Whereas Madoka eventually, spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen Madoka, sacrifices herself for the sake of everybody else in the world and every other magical girl. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Graham, I have one issue with this, which is that you have called Homura evil, which I think demands a duel. Like, I think we have to fight now, because you have slandered the name of my second favorite character.
Okay, guys, you can have a duel, but I need one of you to use time magic. I need the other of you to use a magic bow.
Ooh,
if you can do
awesome.
That for me, then you guys can duel.
I don't know if I have the legs for that skirt, but I'll work on it.
I think Oren has to use the magic bow, because I was going to say, I really love Homura, but I mean, there is that movie where she becomes the devil, the literal devil.
I am not
Homura is definitely a good guy, but, like, she does have that, again, Madoka Magica is, like, a deconstruction of the Magic Girl girl, and so, like, how she's presented in the beginning is definitely the dark magical girl archetype, you know, mm-hmm. which is very common
yeah.
in magical girl anime. You have the magical girl, and then you have the dark magical girl, which is her dark reflection, and it's clear that when the show is set up, Homura is supposed to look like she is in that role.
Yeah, I guess she's more an anti-hero than a villain. I should correct myself there.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, I don't feel like it's necessarily unfair to call her the evil reflection, because that is the way that she is purposely set up to appear in the beginning, even though what we actually find out is that she's a good guy who's just been really, like, disillusioned.
Right, and we also find out, like, it's not wrong to say that Homura is definitely willing to kill other people who haven't done
yep.
anything wrong if it will help her save Madoka, right? Like,
yeah.
she doesn't go on rampages for no reason, but we see, like, she would definitely kill Sayaka.
Oh yeah, no, she tells Sayaka that she has no value in her life, and that she is, to her, a game piece. And, it, you know, if the minute that she's not useful anymore, she'll let her die. Because she's been ground down to this point where she doesn't care about anyone that doesn't matter.
And I think that part that Homura's motivation that we saw, I think in this case that actually helped develop Madoka's character rather than the reverse, because Madoka's character, because she's very, you know, she's sort of the personification of good, right? And that kind of character can be really easy to get wrong and make, like, super cheesy and insufferable. But I think because she has the contrast of Homura, who is almost the polar opposite of her, the fact that she is, you know, all generous and, like, you know, all giving and all self-sacrificing, I think that works better than it would without the contrast.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly not obnoxious or in your face. She just is good, you know, which is great. I think my favorite example of a hero with a dark reflection is Paranorman. So, in Paranorman is a animated movie about a boy who can see ghosts, and he's an outcast because he can see ghosts because people consider him weird. And so he really feels he gets bullied at school, and his parents are really worried about him. So even at home, he doesn't feel comfortable. His main source of emotional support is his dead grandmother, because he talks to her ghosts.
Oh, I love that part.
Yeah. So the story takes place in, I don't know if it's what the town is called, but it's Salem. It's supposed to be Salem.
Oh.
That has and they go into this backstory of this big history of this, you know, witch that was, you know, executed a long time ago. And then it turns out there is an actual, like, curse on the town. And Norman sort of inherits the responsibility of taking care of it. And it's this witch's curse, which becomes active. And then at the very end, I mean, it's not a story that really has villains, just flawed people. You know, like, the villains, all the villains are sympathetic. And when we finally get to the point where we meet the witch, we find out that she is very much like Norman. That she is a little girl, she's not even an adult, and that she had a special gift that she was killed for. And it really brings out the fact that Norman is dealing with many of the same problems that she was dealing with. And her ghost now is very, very angry, you know, at all of the people who killed her. And so then he has to sort of process his own, like, hey, people are flawed. You know, I know people are really mean to me, but they're really flawed. And talk her down. Which really, really caps off his arc really well. So it really, like, makes the story complete to have that, those dynamics. And it makes, you know, the villains very, very sympathetic.
I want to throw out one more example before we get to things that, like, don't work, and this might be a good lead-in.
Yeah.
Which is, I think Dark Reflections can finally be used as sort of a commentary on differing ideologies, especially since, as we've noted, Dark Reflections work really well when the hero comes from the same place, and the villain comes from the same place. And the Kamen Rider franchise in Japan actually has kind of a tradition of this, where the villain and the hero, or the hero and the anti-hero, come from the same place, but they then have ideals that cause them to clash. And one of the most recent series, and the one I'm most familiar with, Kamen Rider Gaim, there's a lot of similarity between the hero, Kamen Rider Gaim, or Kota, and his dark counterpart, Baron? Yeah, Baron. Baron is how it's pronounced. It would be in Japanese Baron, but it's Baron. And they have the same powers, which they get from alien fruit.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
And then they fight initially over dance territory, because it's a really weird show. But they even become the same sort of weird hybrid creature in the end. But Kota is motivated all along by this belief that humanity just needs a chance to pick itself back up, and people are inherently good, and, you know, if we all work together, we can win. Whereas Kaito, or Baron, is an extreme cynic who comes from this... he was slightly more impoverished than Kota, who's still very working class. But he, like, saw his dad get beaten up by, like, loan sharks this one time. It helped motivate him to this cynical belief that humanity's natural state is conflict between strong and weak. And the only way to create a fair world would be to become as strong as you could and just smash the existing order into the ground. And he never gives that up.
I think I went to seminar with that guy.
Yeah, probably.
Wasn't that what, like, Alexander the Great, like, his idea was that if he just, like, conquered the entire world, then he could just, like, eliminate differences between people, and then everybody would go along?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
I'm sure that motivation has been attributed to Alexander the Great at some point. I feel like Alexander the Great is everyone's, like, favorite, why did he do this? It's often not entirely clear why he did the things he did.
Did he just want to get to the ocean? Who knows?
Yeah, maybe he just was going for a walk and brought his army with him, like you do. But, okay, so Graham, I do have one question about the Kamen Rider thing, because this is a show that sounds like it goes to some very strange places. So when you said that his dad got beaten up by loan sharks, were those, like, actual sharks?
No, they were not actual sharks. Although that's a very good question. No. They were,
did his dad owe them kittens? Because I hear...
No, his dad did not owe them kittens or fruit. The show is very weird, though, and that's a legitimate question to ask, because this is a show that, or a franchise, rather, that has characters that include an arm that is actually a bird and a belt that talks to you. These are real characters with development. They're not in the same series, but they're in the same franchise.
I'm into it. So we are running out of time, because we've been talking about this for a bit, but I do want to, another pitfall that I want to bring up before we end is when you're introducing a dark reflection, and this is most often to happen in like a serialized story, because if you're doing it all at once, you can kind of change it to make sure it works. But if you're introducing a dark reflection, make sure that they are actually a dark reflection and not just things the character has actually done. In Star Trek Voyager.
He was going to bring up Voyager, folks.
I had to. There's an episode called Equinox where Captain Janeway and Voyager run into this other Starfleet ship that was transported into the Delta Quadrant and was like ahead of them. And never mind why they've never heard of this other Starfleet ship passing through, but that is a question for another time. But the premise of this episode is that the captain of the Equinox, this guy named Ransom, has been basically capturing aliens and killing them to generate super fuel to get his ship home faster. And, you know, that's a pretty bad thing to do, right? Like, obviously, you shouldn't do that. And then Janeway is all like, you know, I'm gonna get you because I'm the good captain and you're the evil captain. And, like, I've done some things to get my crew home that were maybe a little questionable, but, like, you know, I've never sunk to your level. So you're my evil reflection. But, like, Janeway has done way worse things than that. Like, you know.
It's true.
Like, just a few episodes ago, Janeway gave bioweapons to the Borg to, like, so
because
that they could,
you
know. Yeah, so like you do, so that they could try to wipe out Species 8472 that was in a war with the Borg, a defensive war against the Borg, I should point out. The Borg attacked them.
But Species 8472 was mad scary, Oren. So creepy.
And, like, Janeway decided that they were evil based on the testimony of a 3-year-old elf, like, who had read the minds of one of their panicked combat pilots and derided from that they wanted to kill all life. And it's kind of like if if some aliens came to Earth and, like, you know, read the mind of, like, a soldier in the middle of a war who was being shot at and was like, well, this guy wants to kill the people he's around, so clearly all humans want to kill everyone, is kind of, you know, it's sort of the scenario.
If you can't trust a 3-year-old, you know, adorable elf woman who is in a really abusive relationship, who can you trust?
Well, fortunately, she was out of that relationship by then. She had broken up with Neelix through the power of Space Hitler. And I am not even joking. But that is another topic for another time. Yeah.
My favorite part of those episodes is the moment where the captain of the Equinox asks Janeway, have you ever broken the Prime Directive in order to get your crew home? And she's like, never. And it's like, what are you talking about, Janeway? You break the Prime Directive all of the time.
Never, except, like, these 30 times.
Yeah, except for the episodes where it's, like, plot convenient to, like, insist that you have to follow the Prime Directive. Then she doesn't, you know, violate it, but...
Right. So anyway, that's, like, a thing that can happen sometimes, where it's, like, you have a character that's already done some really dark stuff, and you're like, well, I'm gonna introduce a dark reflection. It's like, well, this dark reflection isn't actually worse. Star Trek doesn't have a great track record with dark reflections. Like, even though I love Deep Space Nine, they tried to make Dukat a dark reflection of Sisko by, like, but it didn't really work because Sisko and Dukat didn't really have anything in common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Dukat was always had more chemistry with Kira anyway, but in the later season, they were like, we're going to make Dukat the emissary of the Paw Wraiths, because Sisko is the emissary of the prophets, so he can be, like, the space antichrist, which Jesus is space Jesus. Excuse me, to Sisko space Jesus. And it just didn't work out. It was just, like, it felt very forced.
I will also say DS9 had the alternate universe episodes where they showed, like, Kira as being this, like, this fascist leader of the Bajorans, and it, and like, as interesting as it is to see characters, like, being in with different lives and different positions and different attitudes, like, it just wasn't believable that she could be this other character. It didn't feel like her anymore. You know, there wasn't any Kira left.
Yeah, Intendant Kira was so different from Major Kira that that even in the initial episodes, it was like, this is really weird. And I think Dukat was he was way too established for when they tried to do his flip around that to make it work at all. Because, I mean, even when they made him like this guy who was obsessed with Bajor as compared to his initial character where he just wanted Bajor back because he had power and he missed power, it kind of clashed because it was like, well, okay, you're obsessed with Bajor. Why didn't we see any sign of that initially? Initially, you just wanted Bajor back because you wanted prestige.
Yeah, it wasn't established as well as it could have been. I do think that in the DS9 Dark Universe episodes, or Mirror Universe episodes, Mirror Sisko is actually probably the closest to an actual reflection, because Mirror Sisko, and I think part of this has to do with just how much presence Avery Brooks has as an actor, because even in normal Sisko, we get a feeling that he has a lot of violence. Like, it's restrained, right? Like, he's not a sociopath.
Yeah.
He's not just gonna beat up on you for no reason, but it's there.
If you provoke him, he's not above going to violence. I mean, as we saw with Q in the one episode Q ever showed up.
he will punch Q in the face, right? And he is a very intense person. And I think Mirror Sisko showed a version of him that could realistically have happened if he was just in a situation where he didn't have Starfleet training or Starfleet ideals, and he was just, like, told, well, it's kill or be killed, look out for you and yours as best you can. And that was the situation he ended up in. And it was, I always thought it was unfortunate that they killed Mirror Sisko between episodes so that regular Sisko could have to impersonate him.
Yeah.
I always thought that was disappointing. All right, do either of you have any final thoughts on Heroes with Evil Reflections? Because we were just about out of time.
Other than that, I am your evil reflection and will eventually usurp all that you love, no.
That's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, I think I can see that how where your character arc is going. I think this is
okay.
It should be exciting for the next episode.
Ooh. All right, well, I'm excited. I am eager to see what happens next. If anything that we said, you, at the listeners at home, if we piqued your interest at all, you can email us at podcast@mythcreants.com. Otherwise, we will see you next week.
There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess.
You can subscribe to the MythCreant podcast through Stitcher, iTunes Radio, or find us at MythCreants.com. Opening and closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.